Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
Overall, I think it's good to every year, you know, it's important to take an assessment and to say, you know, what went right, what didn't go so right, what do we need to improve, but also, what is our marriage speaking to those around us?
Yeah. Ashley Willis on Focus on the Family Minute.
Like, what is that overarching message? And I know, you know, for us, I mean, there's many, many things that we want to leave behind as a legacy, but I think the biggest one is that marriage is awesome. Like, you know, even going through the hard moments, marriage is wonderful. It is a gift, and that there is hope even in the hard times. That's something that we always want to point to. But I think for every couple, just coming back to that reason that God brought them together, because I think in hard seasons, especially those broken seasons we talked about, we lose sight of that because we're just in critical condition. We're just trying to survive, right? But in order to thrive, we have to think about that bigger picture.
More from Ashley and her husband Dave at FamilyMinute.org.
Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
Hi, this is Chris from We Help You Legal. Legal documents should be simple and affordable. At We Help You Legal, there are no lawyers and no high costs. Just certified experts to assist you with living trusts, wills, divorce matters, corporations, and LLCs.
Hi, I'm Christina. We also offer notary services. You can find us online at WeHelpYouLegal.com or call 805-237-7770.
We Help You Legal, your Central Coast legal document company.
Long for the good old County Board of Supervisors days, when districts weren't gerrymandered to promote a socialist agenda, when supervisors who lived over the water basin actually voted on the water issues, when our public safety in the county took priority over overpriced consultants and mental health for the homeless. Come to Slo County Tea Party meeting Monday, 6 p.m. April 6th, and meet our future District 4 Supervisor, Adam Verdin. Adam will help right the ship and bring sanity back to Slo County. Come early to meet and support Adam.
Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story, brought to you by Frontier Floors and Window Coverings at 830 21st Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-7878 or online at frontierfloors.net.
The Rest of the Story. Once upon a time in the Russia of another century, there were two men, both of them educators. Ilya was principal of a small town grammar school. Fyodor was principal of the high school in that same town. Ilya and Fyodor had more than admiration and education in common. They were both fathers of April-born sons. Fyodor's boy was a preschooler. Ilya's was already a teenager, a student at the high school where Fyodor was principal. Now, there's every indication that these two devoted friends had a mutual agreement that if either should die, the survivor would look after the other's son, would become in every respect his godfather. Well, one day Ilya passed away, and sure enough, when the will was read, Fyodor was named as legal guardian of his friend's teenage son. Now, as in all Russian stories, it seems there is a potential for confusion, all of the names and the personal interrelationships. I'm going to try to uncomplicate things as much as possible by focusing for the moment on just the one relationship, that of Fyodor, the high school principal, and his godson, Vladimir. Now, remember, Vladimir was a student at his godfather's school. He was an excellent pupil, by the way, a real scholar. Fyodor was terribly fond of him, enormously proud of him. At 17, Vladimir was preparing to graduate. And Fyodor was naturally eager for the boy to continue his education. And here's where this real-life Russian plot gets even more complicated. A bright future was stretched out before Vladimir when suddenly the older brother got into trouble, a lot of trouble. In fact, he was implicated in a plot to assassinate the Tsar. Now, Vladimir had nothing whatsoever to do with it. Still, no creditable university would admit even the innocent brother of such a criminal. And thus were Vladimir's hopes dashed. Almost. Almost. For it was then that his godfather Fyodor came to the rescue, and he wrote a letter to the administrators of Kazan University, a glowing recommendation of his godson, and the lengthy plaudit said in part that Vladimir was first in all subjects, that neither in or out of school by word or deed had he ever once caused his teachers or school authorities to be dissatisfied, that his religious upbringing, was apparent in his exemplary conduct. Well, so compelling were those words and so respected was the man who had written them that young Vladimir was promptly accepted by the university. But then who could have imagined the rest of the story? Now, you remember Fyodor, the high school principal, had a son of his own. He at this time was 6 years young. His name was Alexander. Precisely 30 years later, after the fall of the Romanov dynasty, he, Alexander Kerensky, became premier of Russia. But it was the Kerensky government which was toppled in October of that same year, 1917, by the so-called Bolshevik Revolution. And that revolution was led by his political enemy, his father's beloved godson, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. Of course, you know Vladimir by his adopted alias, Lenin. Only now you know the rest of the story.
This hour of Sound Off on KPRL brought to you by the Book Heating and Air, your local reliable heating and air expert. Call 805-423-5119.
238-5775. 238-KPRL. Sound Off continues on KPRL, the North County's number one choice for news, talk, and sports. This is Sound Off on the right choice, KPRL.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Vili, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoon. Today I have Chuck Bell. He is with the, what do you do with the Taxpayer Association? What is your role there?
The Central Coast Taxpayers Association. I'm a member of the board. Andrea Seastrand is our president of the board.
And you're on the state Howard Jarvis
Taxpayers Association board.
And you're fighting against the slow cog tax then with the Howard Jarvis, correct?
Well, I think Howard Jarvis and CCTA are opposed to it, yes. Because they haven't really qualified for the ballot, no one's taken a position on it.
And we are taking phone calls and text messages. Same phone number, 238-5775, 805-238-5775. Now, you were bringing up earlier using public resources for anything political or election related. It's generally not permitted, but I was sent, and I sent you a copy of it, but I was sent, our clerk recorder, Elaine Kano, sent out an email probably about a month ago as all the arguments over the SAFE Act were coming in. I'm going to take a call first, then we'll get into that. Welcome to Sound Off. What would you like to bring to the conversation?
Thank you, Karen. Good morning, Chuck, or lunch or whatever. Hey, so public funds being used to promote a direction of something, and thank you for your help with Amy Sparrow on the 218 from Howard Jarvis. So this proposed water authority had a 218 vote, and we found out that monies that they used came from the grant, which is directly in violation of the grant agreement, which are public funds. So they used hundreds of thousands of dollars to promote their 218 from this grant money. So would that be something that would be filed with the fair practices deal of the wrong application of this money?
Well, that's it's an interesting question. Support generally under the case law and under the statute that's in the Political Reform Act requires that the agency be engaged in express advocacy of the passage of a measure.
because this, the agreement specifically stated what you could and could not spend the grant money on. And one of the items was you could not spend any of the grant money to create another board, which was this JPA, and their decision to become a water authority, and to carry out the Sigma requirements. So it specifically said that in that deal. And so they're taking our tax dollars through a grant, applying for the grant, and then illegally using the grant in an improper way to promote something that specifically says can't be promoted.
And Greg, one of the things that I found, Julie Tacker has several times reported that grant money was not used correctly. And what she does is she looks at it, proves it, she puts together a little complaint about it, and she sends it to the grant company and the attorney general. She goes after it. And she's had millions of dollars returned. Government bodies have had to give it back. San Simeon had to give a ton of money back because they got it for one thing and were using it for another. This is a major issue in our country right now, misspending of grant money, and there is a way to fight it.
Yeah, and they're also still, because they had two other amendments for this same grant to extend the monies, but that part of the agreement has never changed. And now they're promoting this Prop 26 because they lost the 218. And now they want to claim it's a fee and not a tax. But there has to be a specific benefit, which they haven't been able to show us. It's just amazing. But I wanted to thank you, Chuck, for
sure. Well,
for the help on that.
I certainly agree with Karen that I think probably the route to go is with the grant making body and with respect to the other violation of the terms of the grant. The FPPC, in theory, could get involved if it were determined that they had used the money for express advocacy of the passage of the measure.
Yeah. Well, you know how they thought, because they picked the recipients of who they were going to send the 218 notices to. So they were picking who they wanted, and of course, you know, it's an automatic yes unless you send in the protest. And then their own people protested against them because they were never asked if they wanted to do this. But again, I thank you, and I appreciate your help all the time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling in. Welcome to Sound Off. What would you like to ask Chuck Bell?
Yeah, hi, Karen. This is Murray.
Hey, Murray.
Hi, Murray Powell. I just wanted to go back for a couple minutes on this these road situations you were talking about before the break. You mentioned this Templeton Trail deal, which you and I talked about a little earlier today. And I just, people need to understand that that this was a public works project that nobody knew was coming, and then a week ago, TAG got a notice on it, and I sent you that this morning. But in any event, you mentioned that yesterday that Pichong on a KPR radio show had mentioned the $30 million estimate on this little project, this 1 mile trail connection deal. And I actually talked to Public Works about an hour and a half ago and got a hold of a guy who's kind of dealing with it. And he told me that the estimated cost right now, which is very, very preliminary, so you can't really hang your hat on it, is $5 to $10 million. And like I told you, if people could see this, these photos of this project referral and see this huge, I'll call it overpass bridge, we actually call it the Stairway to Heaven, probably 3 or 4 story high, huge bridge over the Union Pacific Railroad tracks there. It's just mind-boggling that the county would actually be looking at proceeding with this kind of project. And, of course, funding is always a problem, and they want to call it a traffic corridor, so that would pull in money for roads to improve this little trail that most people have never been on or heard of. And I live in Templeton, about not even 2 miles away from where that is, and never heard about it for 30 years, and so on. So, and this all ties right back into this whole the sales tax, road tax deal, where, you know, to me it's a sham. You know, so we're supposed to start increase our taxes, pay out $35 million a year in sales tax in hopes of getting some of it back from the state if they like us that particular year and if they have any money to somehow dole out around the whole county for different road projects. And, of course, you mentioned SLOCOG, and people should know that the 7 regular cities in our county all have a seat. And then I believe each one of our supervisors in the unincorporated areas also have a seat. So we're already, even though they have a program they put out about allocating all of this so-called wish list money coming back from the state, which I'll believe it when I see it. We've heard about all these kinds of deals before, and you figure out that nothing ever happens or we lose money. Anyway, you know, it's like this money is going to be doled out more by the cities than by the state. I mean, I'm sorry, by the county. So, you know, this is just another pie-in-the-sky deal. So we tax ourselves more money, and then maybe they'll send some of our money back that we've already paid, that we should be getting anyway. Matter of fact, we should have never sent it to them in the first place. We should just be using it for our own purposes. So that's what I have to say at the moment.
Okay, thank you for calling in. I'm going to let him answer while you're off the air. This thing with these traffic corridors, where they claim a bike lane is for people getting to work, and then they use traffic money for it while the roads nearby are falling apart. Is this something new, or has this been happening for a long time?
Well, I haven't paid that much attention to this over the years, but I do recall that the Bob Jones Trail was there in order to get the close the gap in funding for that thing, which became more expensive as time went along, as seems to be the case with almost everything these days, was to call it a transportation corridor, and that put it into the mix for getting transportation funds from the state, I think. So, you know, I think the question is, you know, is that a transportation corridor? It's not carrying a whole raft of vehicles and probably very few bicycles at one time even. So.
And I'm going to get back to the Elaine Kano thing. So, again, they were pushing the SAFE Act in Congress. And let me explain. The SAFE Act was for two things. The main thing was they wanted photo ID. They wanted to allow 5 types of photo ID. Remember that word, photo ID. And it was a driver's license, an ID card, a passport, and 2 others. But photo ID was the requirement. And also that non-U.S. citizens were not permitted to vote. Those were the 2 requirements of that. Meanwhile, Elaine Kano sent out, using the government website, you posted it. It's on the, you can find it. It's an announcement she made, is why you should be opposed to this, because she claims that they were going to need birth certificates in California, and it You know, could you imagine having to carry your birth certificate around with you? But it, not only was that not accurate, that's a political argument, and she used government resources. What did you, did you find that a little bit concerning?
Well, I don't know if there are any other examples where she or has taken a position on a matter of legislation, be it state or federal, that was pending in terms of either the legal or the practical issues that might be raised by the proposal. I know she was not the clerk recorder of San Luis Obispo County when the state legislature basically substantially changed the state law in many ways to provide for all mail balloting, to provide for vote center balloting that basically has supplanted precinct by precinct voting, and to provide for early voting and indeed for receipt and counting of ballots that have been not received by the election department but postmarked for election day. All of these things have contributed to the complication of California's voting system, such that we're kind of a public example nationally for the slow processing of final results of elections. So those are issues that I don't recall the county registrars of voters getting involved in. The SAVE Act, which, as you described, is primarily to establish at the federal level a uniform requirement that states and local jurisdictions that handle counties require the voter to present actual photo identification at the polls or when registering to vote.
We're going to take a break, a word from our sponsors, and be back with more with Chuck Bell.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Liz Klayman, and this is the Fox Business Report.
Stocks kicking off the new quarter higher as investors digest fresh economic data while trying to anticipate the end to the Iranian conflict. The Dow entered correction territory last week, but it's having its best three-day stretch in nearly a year. However, the blue chip index is coming off of its worst month since September of 2022. U.S. oil was down over $99 a barrel, while Brent crude, the international benchmark, was around $101. As a result of declining oil prices, shares of Chevron and ExxonMobil and other energy stocks dropped. Most all of the 11 S&P 500 sectors were higher, with tech and industrials the best performers. The Dow winners, Caterpillar, Goldman Sachs, and Boeing. The Dow decliners, Chevron, Nike, and Visa. The Dow up 224 points. The Nasdaq higher by 250. S&P 500 up 47. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Hillary Barsky, invested in you.
Need life insurance but have diabetes, high blood pressure, or on anxiety meds? If you're a 50-year-old male, even porky, or with type 2 diabetes, $1 million of life insurance may only cost you about $200 a month. For affordable term life insurance, call Term Provider and speak with Big Lou at 800-444-2013. 800-444-2013 or visit BigLou.com. Remember, Big Lou's like you. He's on meds too. 800-444-2013.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stiefel, 238-3080.
Central Coast Tractor Work, with decades of construction and earthwork experience. They are the go-to outfit for all your home, farm, and ranch excavation needs. They do site prep, excavation, grading, trenching, utility work, demolition. They even do brush removal and lots more. They handle it all, and no job is too small. Call them today and get your project moving. And by the way, they work weekends. Central Coast Tractor Work, 805-440-6361.
Have you felt that instant panic when your car breaks down? You deserve to be treated like a guest, not a problem. At Shifton Gears Auto Repair, they're shifting expectations with hospitality-geared auto service. Transparent updates, honest answers. They have your back from the moment you call, and they are always ready to serve you. Next. Finally, auto repair that puts you first.
The Sound Off lines are open at 238-5775. 238-KPRL. The North County's listening to you on Sound Off.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Vealy, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoons. On Thursday this week, I'm going to have David Duringer and Josh Friedman. We're going to be talking about what's going on in Ukraine. David has family there, and Josh visits regularly. He has been there as a CalCoast applied for him to be a war correspondent. He's actually allowed, he's a journalist, he's legal media with the war in Ukraine right now, and he does go regularly. I think he's headed back fairly soon. And today I have Chuck Bell on the show. Chuck, you were talking before we left a little bit about Elaine Kano, and the idea is you're not supposed to use public resources on campaign issues.
I looked at what she wrote, and she didn't explicitly say they should not pass this, but she raised a lot of objections to it, some of which were technical. I don't believe she had any legal objections. Let me just say as to whether this is legal or not, there's been a dispute about whether the federal government can adopt pass a statute to provide for photo voter identification and to prohibit illegal migrants from voting. And there is a provision in the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, that seems to divide the responsibility between elections, between Congress and the states. And however, the Congress in the last three decades has passed at least three measures, the Motor Voter Law in the 1990s, the Help America Vote Act after the 2001 election, Bush versus Gore election, and then again the MOVE Act more recently, which concerns voting the IOCAVA, the overseas voters. And so there has been a regular history of Congress doing this. Currently, I think about 30 states in the country maybe a little more have photo voter identification as a requirement for registration and voting, and some don't. California vehemently opposes it. The legislature has done everything they could to provide for other means, but not photo identification at the polls. In 2008, the United States Supreme Court in the Crawford case made perfectly clear that it was within the Constitution for states to impose photo voter identification requirements in voting as a reasonable preventive measure to prevent vote fraud. And what photo voter identification does is allow the official at the precinct to look at a photo of the voter or the person who's coming to the polls to vote and establish from the photo that the voter is who he or she says he is. 80% or more of the public supports this, and this is across party and ethnic groups as well, blacks, Latinos, Asians, Democrats, Republicans, independents, all support it, you know, some with varying degrees of support, but the general level of support is 75-80% range. You know, there are some questions about how you deal with things like when someone who is married changes name, and how you get your registration updated. The SAFE Act provides for that and requires the Federal Election Assistance Commission to establish national standards for that. But the Supreme Court, in a number of cases, including the Brnovich case most recently, said that it's not unconstitutional when government imposes requirements to assure the, for example, the protection of the integrity of the ballot, to impose a minor inconveniences on voters to comply with that. And we all know those minor inconveniences when we go to the DMV and have to show some form of identification, proof of birth and so forth, residence, to get our real identifications for the driver's license. So it's, if you want to get on an airplane, if you want to get into a federal court, and interestingly, if you want to get into the Democratic National Convention, voter identification is required. So it's not the unreasonable requirement here that's going to limit or discriminate against any person who is a citizen who wants to register to vote.
And one of the things they did have in there, if you don't have a photo ID, and I know this is going to sound shocking, I came across someone that doesn't have a photo ID. They were in jail for a long time, do not have a photo ID. They need to get one because now there's some money they're supposed to be getting. They can't get hold of it without a photo ID. So they have somebody processing their checks for them and they can't give it to them without a photo ID. And so that was someone, but if people are having a hard time, very often they do need some subsistence and that needs a photo ID.
Well, I think most of these provisions, the SAFE Act includes some that would provide for opportunities for people to get photo identification either on a gratis basis or at a very restricted basis and made it fairly easy to do that. As you know, you can get a passport by taking a picture of yourself and sending it into the passport agency. They take those things. You know, don't smile. They don't want you to smile. They want to see your gums together. For some reason, I think it has to do with the most efficient way to accurately identify someone.
And the SAFE Act required that it was free. If you don't have and you want to vote and you needed an ID, the SAFE Act did say you have to give them an ID, you have to help them get it, and you cannot charge them. Yeah. So it was built into the SAFE Act to get IDs for people.
Let me be clear. I looked at the material she put out, and I don't think she advocated against it, but she certainly had picked up most of the talking points of the Democratic Party. Right now, it's, I think, only the Democratic Party in Congress that is opposed to this. As I said, widely supported in the public. It's an 80-20 issue.
And that, I found it odd that she was pushing party politics, but she was also pushing untruths. You know, she was claiming you're going to have to carry your birth certificate with you. That was not in there, and that wasn't even allowed as a form with the SAFE Act. So she was a bit on the one side on that. I want to get into this judgment now. For those that have been watching this, there was a teacher who first, I think a couple teachers who went and filed that they didn't think, they thought they should be able to tell parents about the, if their child wanted to go by another gender. I think it was at a religious school. And so the teacher then filed a lawsuit against the state of California regarding their rules about gender. You can't tell the parents when they're changing. Some parents then joined the lawsuit, and they ended up getting it, losing, and then taking it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court said the parents have a right to know. They have a right. They are the primary guardians of their children, and the schools in California does not have a right to hide this from the parents. But they determined the teacher didn't have any rights here because the parents joined. This was sent back. The U.S. Supreme Court sent it back. But then, interesting, it's not even over yet. But they have, California has been so adamant over filing. That's basically what they said, just one thing after another, trying to block these parents. And yesterday, the judge ordered California to pay $4.5 million for legal fees.
Well, there's a provision of the Federal Civil Rights Act, Section 1988, which allows a party that prevails in an action against a government agency for violation of their civil rights, in this case, the parental rights of the parents of the children involved, if they prevail, so actually, what happened is that the case was originally decided by a federal court judge, Roger Benitez, in the San Diego federal court. It went up to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit panel ruled against him, and they then took a petition. And what the interim relief was there was that the Ninth Circuit had stay of the decision of the district court judge was overturned by the Supreme Court. So it's not a final decision, but the judge is able, since he has jurisdiction of the case again as a result of the Supreme Court's action, to do auxiliary things in support of his judgment. And one of those was an award of attorney's fees. So it is not unusual, but it was consistent with what the federal law requires. Now, my guess is that the state will pursue its appeal up, notwithstanding that the writing is certainly on the wall from the U.S. Supreme Court on what it thinks on the substance of this case. But I'm sure they'll probably appeal the award of attorney's fees as well. And that will, if the Supreme Court sustains on appeal to what it did on this motion in the last few days, it will most likely send it back to the judge and allow that attorney fee award to be sustained. Whether additional fees will be awarded is another question. It's possible.
That's a huge amount of money. I found it to be a huge amount of money that these parents have had to pay. And one thing they did say in the ruling was it was partly because the state of California is responsible for this. They were so pushy, filing so many things. And as someone that's been in some lawsuits, you have those attorneys that just try to paper you.
Well, that may well be. That may well be that that's... this is a complicated issue, and there have been a number of cases that have been kind of making their way up through the courts, both the state courts and the federal courts, for really the last maybe 5 or 6 years. So this one is the first one to get a sort of a definitive ruling out of the U.S. Supreme Court. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens, whether the state does appeal. I think they will. I've listened to Attorney General Bonta on a few things, and if he's in charge of the appeal. I think he wants to fight the administration and even the Supreme Court apparent majority on this as hard as he can.
So. And I wanna touch for a minute on Gay Appel. Gay Appel is a candidate for clerk recorder. She's one of three candidates for clerk recorder in our county. She is going to be on my show next week talking about why she's running and also a little bit about what's going on with her legal case. And I'm going to come back and tell you a little bit about what happened in court when we come back after a word from our sponsors.
When it comes to selling your home in the North County, one agent can only do so much.
That's why we show up as a team.
I'm Seth Peek.
And I'm Karen Peek.
And we're the Peek team.
And equal partners in every sale.
Pricing, marketing, negotiations.
We both do it all.
Two professionals reviewing every detail.
Two voices advocating for you at every step.
We tag team the work.
So nothing gets missed.
One mission.
Sell your home with minimized headaches.
We're the Peek team.
At Peek Realty.
And we work together for you.
Thinking about selling your home in North County? Reach the Peek team at Peek Realty. Just Google Peek Realty, that's P-E-E-K Realty. The Peek team at Peek Realty live wonderfully on the Central Coast.
DRE number 0219910.
As the markets have their ups and downs, real estate remains one of the most stable assets in everyone's portfolio. Hi, this is Cindy Mims, owner broker of Colony Mortgage, voted best mortgage company in North County 3 years running. We offer conventional FHA, VA, and reverse mortgages and 100% purchase loans for first-time home buyers. Are you a builder and tired of the red tape when dealing with banks and expensive hard money loans? I have a great new option. Or are you 62 years or older? You can possibly eliminate your monthly mortgage payment and get cash in your pocket. At Colony Mortgage, we have hometown service with competitive rates. We have years of experience with creative financing to find that right loan for you. If it's credit issues stopping you, let us help. We move from our 20-year Atascadero location and now offer two convenient locations to meet personally in Atascadero and Paso Robles. Call 805-466-3598. Thank you for supporting your local businesses.
When it comes to sustainable energy systems and service, Central Coast residents trust Solarponics. Marilyn from Templeton says, quote, Solarponics installed our system almost 20 years ago. There are occasions when your system needs to be serviced. With Solarponics, work is completed quickly with knowledge and skill. This is as important a part of a solar company as the original installation. Thank you, Marilyn, for your Google review. When we install a sustainable energy system, we're installing a lifetime of as important service. Don't just go solar, go Solarponics. Solarponics.com.
Attention Central Coast homeowners. Is your water heater over 7 years old? If so, replace it with a heat pump water heater before it fails and save thousands in energy costs. Plus, new rebates cover up to 80% of the cost. Call or click to get a free, no-hassle quote today. Don't just go solar, go Solarponics. Solarponics.com.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Veeley, your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoons. Also an investigative reporter with Cal Coast News. Go to Cal Coast News. There's no paywall. So today, as many of you know, maybe you don't know, there was a complaint by the clerk recorder's office, I think it was probably 2 years ago, that Arroyo Grande mayor candidate Gaya Powell was not living where she was supposed to be living to run for mayor. And it was sent to the DA's office. the DA's office did find a number of things they said they believed were illegal. They filed charges against her. And today was, and then Gaye Appel has come back out. She's running for clerk recorder. She has said she believes this was politically done. She said that she had permission in an email from the AG city clerk that she had two rental residences and that she could leave at either one. And she had some arguments, so she was hoping to go in to her preliminary hearing today and have the judge throw it out. I was only there for the first part where the people were speaking, where the prosecutors were calling their witnesses. So I did not see the part where Gaye called her witnesses. I have someone in there. I'll learn about that after the show today. But basically what has happened today is it started with, the argument is by law, you're supposed to be registered to vote at your primary residence. You can't spend a week, a year somewhere and then claim and vote from there as if you live in that area. You're supposed to live in that area. Am I correct?
Yeah, basically, that's right. Everyone can register to vote. They have to determine which is their domicile. That is the place where they intend to reside and remain. And even if they leave it, they can maintain that domicile, but it has to be their intent that that they live there. And there are a number of indicators, you know, where you can register to vote. Where's the licensed driver's license address? Where do you receive mail? Where do you receive utility bills? Where do you spend the most of your time? It can get a little complicated, but I've advised over the years literally hundreds of candidates about this, and because there are potential legal penalties associated with not complying with that, including making perjurious statements that this is your residence and that sort of thing. There's some potential criminal penalties that do apply. So I don't know the facts of this particular case. I've heard, I saw the complaint that was filed against her when she was charged with offenses. And I think they include a few things in addition to just, you know, improperly registered and committing perjury.
Absolutely. It's it was voting where you didn't live. It was in registering to vote where you didn't live, running where you didn't live, claiming that you weren't raising, not doing a campaign, and spending over $2,000. And one of the things they were talking about also is there was a third thing that they were talking about today during the case. The first witness today was Carolyn Moffitt. She is a landlord where at a home, they live in the front house. It's in the county property. It's outside of AG. And Gaye and her husband, Mike, rent an ADU right behind them or right close to them. The landlord said she's been staying here. She's never not been staying here. She told me she was renting an office. The landlord said that she had talked to her, and the landlord was on the Harbor District Commission for 24 years. And she testified that she sat down with her and told her one day, you know, you need to be careful. You're supposed to be living in the city. And she said, I know what I'm doing. I talked to an attorney. I'm allowed to do this. The woman testified that Gaye told her that was an office that she was renting at inside the city limits. Gaye, when she was asking, Gaye is her own attorney. She brought up that she didn't say that. She said, wouldn't you be surprised to know that I never spoke to you? So Gaia was basically arguing through her questions that she never, that this didn't happen, that she didn't call it an office, that she didn't discuss this with her on several occasions. So that was the first witness. And that didn't go well for Gaia because she's claiming I'm living at the other one. And what she said is I got sick and couldn't move completely in. But if it's an office, you can't use an office as your address so you can be a mayor somewhere, can you?
No.
And I don't know what's going to happen. I didn't hear Gaia's arguments.
Well, this just to be clear, this is a preliminary hearing, and at this stage, the question is, is there sufficient evidence for the prosecution to proceed to trial? And it's a preliminary hearing is an opportunity for a defendant to raise issues that the defendant believes show that the prosecutor doesn't have enough evidence to move forward to trial. It's an important part of our procedure. I don't know any of the facts in this case on either side, and I don't know who her witnesses might be on the other side. It's unusual, actually, that a case will have a sort of a contested preliminary hearing. But we're talking about felony offenses here, and so she certainly has her right to go that direction, attempt to defend herself.
Gaia told me about a week ago she absolutely expected to win today. So, and I don't know what was pulled out later, but she told me that she absolutely expects to win and it not to go to trial after the preliminary hearing. So there, as soon as I find out what happened, I'll post a story on Cal Coast News. The second witness was the clerk recorder, or not the clerk recorder, the clerk, the city clerk in Arroyo Grande. And one of the contentions was about an email that Gaia is arguing means that she told me it doesn't matter where I'm living primarily right now, but after I get in office, I have to live there permanently, primarily. But the argument from the other side is you still had to be registered to vote, and there's requirements for registered. So that was the second witness. And the third witness was the person renting her a space that was in the city. And that was more that it was an office and she hadn't moved in furniture. But that person said they weren't keeping track if she ever stayed there. They were unaware. They didn't believe she was there very often, but they were unaware if she actually ever stayed in the property. And again, I won't know the rest of what's going on. How bad are these felonies? If she's found guilty, what is it? There's quite a few felonies in this. What would be a jail sentence on that?
Well, there is some discretion on the part of the judge as to what a sentence would be if she's found guilty. I think because these are not violent crimes or anything like that, that typically there's some leniency that's applied. I recall that there was another voter registration case involving
Michelle Morrow,
where she had a similar residency problem, and I think she got a limited amount of jail time and some probation.
And that was a bracelet at home. I don't think she had to spend any time in the jail.
Yeah. Interestingly, Eric Swalwell, who's the current Democratic candidate for governor, faced a charge from an opponent that he was not, and the rules applied to congressional are different than for state and local.
Well, thank you for coming in very much, and Again, tomorrow we will have David Duringer and Josh Friedman talking about Ukraine.
This hour of Sound Off was brought to you by Mid-State Precious Metals across the parking lot from the movie theater in Atascadero. Honest, veteran-owned. Buy or sell precious metals with integrity. Monday through Friday, 10 to 3.
AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.